Gino Barbero. Fantastic New York Italian name. Gino, welcome to the show, buddy.
Thanks, Matt.
What was your educational background?
First kid to go to college in my family, graduated with a finance degree, worked for AIG. I worked in a cubicle. It was soul sucking. After that, I said, Dad, I can't do this. Let's open a restaurant. My father was an immigrant from Italy, moved to Brooklyn back in the late 50s, and we opened the restaurant back in 1994. There you go. There's the classic stereotypical Italian owning a restaurant with their family, but that's what I did.
Is that what you did for your whole career?
They didn't want me to go into the business, and now I know why. How am I going to feed six children through one restaurant that's making less money? I was stuck. For me to leave that whole negative feeling of being there, my mom telling me, you can't take risks, we have to stay small, that really, really hurt. I actually invested and owned 200 apartment units before she even knew I was partnered with my business partner, Jake. I was the pizza guy, but I didn't want to be the pizza guy anymore.
Good evening, guys. Matt Haycocks here, and I'm joined tonight with Gino Barbero. I hope I'm saying that correctly, Gino. I never checked with you before we started, but a fantastic New York Italian name. Gino is the co-founder of Jake and Gino, which specializes in real estate investment. And together with his business partner, Jake, they are now helping other people achieve the similar success to themselves through their educational platform, Jake and Gino. Their community has empowered students to close to 68,000 units and managing $4 billion in real estate deals. And Gino himself has a real estate portfolio with 2,000 multifamily units and $250 million in assets under management. We were having a little bit of a chat before we started to record live, and Gino's got some fantastic advice he's going to be sharing with his three-step real estate investment framework he's developed. But I'm looking forward to talking about the market in general, real estate, and you know, I know you guys who are in different businesses and like to listen to what we do here, I'm sure we'll find some takeaways that are translatable to whatever area you're in. So Gino, welcome to the show, buddy.
Thanks, Matt. And, you know, listen, with your accent, you can say my last name any way you want. It would come out awesome. So, you know, and I'm an Italian. If you want me to sing opera later, I can throw a little bit of opera in there for you. I've been singing for a couple of years. So I got to live up to the Italian heritage. Never knew I could sing. Started singing a couple of years ago. And, you know, rest is history, my friend. How you doing?
Man of many talents. We'll start with real estate, and we might finish off with a bit of opera.
That sounds good. Listen, I didn't get into real estate, Matt. I was a small business owner. I owned a restaurant with my family. So there you go. There's the classic stereotypical Italian owning a restaurant with their family. But that's what I did. My father was an immigrant from Italy. He moved to Brooklyn back in the late 50s, and we opened the restaurant back in 1994. And I had that mom and pop for about 15 years, Matt.
Is that what you did for your whole career then? I mean, what was your educational background?
I went to college, first kid to go to college in my family, graduated with a finance degree, worked for AIG back in 1992 when AIG was a real company. I worked there
That's
for a year.
Insurance guys, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I worked in a cubicle and I said, Matt, I cannot do this shit. It was soul sucking. Reinsurance accounting is like watching paint dry. So I did it for a year. And then after that, I said, Dad, I can't do this. Let's open a restaurant. They didn't want me to open the restaurant. They didn't want me to go into the business. And now I know why, because it's one of the hardest soul-sucking businesses you could possibly do, running a restaurant. But when it's in your blood and your father's done it his whole life, you just think everyone else is doing it. I mean, working 60 hours a week, working on the weekends, working during holidays. And that's ultimately what drove me out. I've got a big family. I've got six children. So I missed a lot in that 15 or 20 years that I owned the restaurant.
We were just talking about a couple of different things before we started recording. One of them was about business owners lying to themselves. And I know this is not exactly a parallel, but it just made me think that when you're talking about like generational family businesses and, you know, particularly like, you know, restaurants that don't make money, et cetera. I mean, is that quite a, let's say, a family business mentality, you think, that the different generations get dragged into the business, it doesn't perform, and, you know, I guess the next generation probably knows it doesn't perform, everybody's living under stress, nobody's making any money, but nobody wants to, you know, wants to disrespect the generation before? And do you think that's why some of these things are prolonged for so long?
It's a great question. For me, we did great until 08. I mean, we made good money. Then 08 came and the restaurant business for me fundamentally shifted. Once you're competing with Grubhub and you're competing with these other entities, the mom and pops can't compete. And I saw the writing on the wall. And it's interesting because I told my mom, I'm getting out of this restaurant business. She didn't believe me. I actually invested and owned 200 apartment units before she even knew I was partnered with my business partner, Jake. And I sat down with her one day in 2013. I said, Mom, I'm leaving this restaurant. And she was beside herself. I think it was part of her identity. I was the pizza guy, but I didn't want to be the pizza guy anymore. And I wanted to become honest with myself. I have six children. How am I going to feed six children through one restaurant that's making less money and I'm working harder? I didn't have the mentality of scaling. I didn't know how to scale the restaurant business. But ironically, within 5 years, I was able to scale the apartment industry with 1,500 units. And I was in that family business. And I don't want to call it a business. It became a job. Because a business is scalable, a business has systems and processes, a business has core values, has mission statements. Most small mom and pop businesses don't have that. And I was so guilty of that and I was stuck. And for me to leave that whole, you know, I don't want to say that whole negative feeling of being there, my mom telling me, you can't take risks. We have to stay small. You know, that really hurt. And when I've met Jake, I said, I don't want to be that mom and pop investor. I want to be able to build I don't want to call it an empire, but 1,800 units in, you know, 7 or 8 years for me is life-changing, was life-changing.
So when did you buy your first piece of real estate?
2002, I bought a triplex with my brother right next to the restaurant. And that was my first taste, but beginner's luck. 2006, I met a man named Maserati Mike, who I like to call him Maserati Mike. He drove in to the restaurant with a gold Maserati. I invested 172 grand with Maserati Mike. And I always say a man with money meets a man with experience, and the man with the experience gets the money, and the man with the money gets the experience. And I lost that 172 grand about 18 months later. And
how? What was the deal? What went wrong?
It's just like, when you get into any kind of business, I didn't know due diligence. I didn't know the underwriting. I didn't go look at the deal. I just thought of passive income. And there is passive income in the world if you do your homework on the front end. I didn't know what the homework on the front end was. I gave my money to this gentleman. Was he a dirtbag? Yeah, but you had said off camera, I had to take the responsibility. I'm the one who gave him the money. I'm the one who partnered up with him. And that money evaporated in 18 months. And, you know, a year after that, I made another real estate mistake. I bought a strip mall in the wrong part of the town, in the wrong part of the market cycle. And Matt, that's when I just said to myself, I need to learn this real estate business. I want to get into housing. I like apartments. It's a basic human need. I like dealing with residents. And that's when I started, you know, these mentorships back in 2008 and 2009. And that's when I met my business partner, Jake. He was what we call the drug rep. He was a pharmaceutical sales guy coming into the restaurant, taking out orders and going to doctor's offices and just, you know, bringing food there and selling drugs to the doctors. And he was sick of his job because real estate was, you know, the healthcare industry back then was shifting fundamentally in 2009 and 2010. So we partnered up in 2011. He moved to Knoxville, Tennessee, of all places. I didn't know where the hell Knoxville, Tennessee was back in 2011. You know, New Yorkers know where New York, New Jersey, Connecticut is. And when he moved down there, he said, you know, take a look at the market. Let's figure it out. It took us 18 months to find the first deal. And in 2013, Jake and I bought our first apartment complex back in 2013.
And that's specifically what you were looking for. You were looking for apartment complexes.
Yeah, I didn't want to fix and flip. I didn't want to get into the single family space. I already had a job. I didn't want another job. I just said, if I can buy this first property, maybe refinance it, pull a little capital out, make some cash flow every month, proof of concept. Let's see how that works. And I had focused on that. And at the time, everyone's going to say, well, that was the right time to get into real estate back in 2011. And everyone was saying, you know, you look at it now, but back then, GDP sucked. I mean, unemployment was terrible. I mean, rents back then for a one bedroom were $300 for one bedrooms. Now they're $1,100. The economy was in the toilet. You couldn't raise capital back then. The debt market sucked. So was it a good time to get into it? Yeah, if you had the mental fortitude. And the reason why I'm telling you this is right now, we are looking at the precipice of what 2011, 2012 were. So if you're thinking of getting into real estate, now actually is the right time to get into real estate because we're going to see asset prices resetting. We're going to see problems in the debt markets. And that gives people the opportunities that we haven't had the last couple of years.
And tell me, what on that first apartment building that you bought, what was your criteria back then? Because, I mean, it sounds very disciplined, waiting 18 months, you know, to find it. So you must have had some very specific criteria, because I'm sure there's many trigger happy people listening to this who would have money burning a hole in the pocket for 18 days. You know, to be able to sit it out for 18 months is very Warren Buffett-esque.
Well, remember, you know, I had the Maserati Mike story. I was already burned. So I already understood that I needed to be patient. I think the second thing was, you have Jake Stenziano and Gino Barbaro, two Italians going down into East Tennessee. Y'all ain't doing business here. It took a little while to ingratiate ourselves with the locals. That's the first thing. The second thing is, we really didn't understand the multifamily game. It was more of a broker relationship. And I think real estate really is relationship centric. And we didn't really create relationships until we found our broker, Rick Gentry. And he's the one who actually brought us our first deal. And to really be specific about criteria, you know, we had talked off camera. We created our framework: buy right, manage right, and finance right. And when we bought this deal, we were looking for a deal that cash flowed. We were looking for anything 30 units and less. We were looking for a deal in Knoxville. Those were the criteria that we started out with, anything we could afford. And we actually had some seller financing, some creative financing on that very first deal. Now, as time has progressed, we've really built out the three-step framework. But really, I think, Matt, the first thing that, you know, anyone listening to this, if you're going to get into real estate, understand your goals. Use the word honesty. Be honest with yourself. If you're looking to do your first deal and you've never done a deal before, I would advise against doing 100 units. I would advise against putting millions of dollars. Think big and start small. Remember, I had the triplex back in 2002. I had a couple of deals that failed, so I already had some experience. So for us, 25 units for me on our first deal with Jake, I had me, Jake, and my brother Mark. There was three of us in the deal. So if I can really break that down, we owned an average of 8 units each. That's something that I could quantify. We needed $87,000 as a down payment for that first deal. Broken up in three ways, I could do that. So I think people get overwhelmed because they're thinking, they hear this 10X and all this BS, go big or go home. Just start. Behaviors are belief driven. If you believe you can do it, then you can do it. If you're telling yourself, I need to do 100 units, I need to do 100 units, you're not going to do it because you can't believe that it can get done. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Well, talk us through the economics of that first deal, because, you know, 24 units and an 87 grand down payment, it sounds a bargain. There must have been some creative finance or some interesting structuring going on there.
Yes. Remember, and that we still own this deal to this day, 10 years later. And I always tell people, the middle-class mindset tells us to save for an event. So at that time, I was saving for my kids' college in a 529 plan. I was saving for retirement. At that moment, I realized that I needed to save to buy an asset to pay for the event. So this asset currently today is producing about $9,000 a month in cash flow. Remember, it's three ways, so I get $3,000 a month. That asset has paid for my first child's college education. It's put my second kid through college, and I still own it. I've got four more to go. That one asset has been able to pay for that event, and I continue to own it. When we bought it, it was $600,000. I remember it was $25,000 a unit. Now people are like, oh my gosh, I can't get that today. But remember, rents were $300. And this is the ultimate mom and pop. They were weekly renters. So people were paying, I remember at the time, $150 a week in rent instead of $450 a month. These are people that were really down on their luck. They could not handle their money. So there's a lot of distress. At that time, we would call it a distressed asset. When the market's flying high, we call it value add. This was distress. This had a lot of hair on it. And I remember 80% down bank financing, 10% creative financing, you know, the seller hold a 10% note, and we came up with 10%. So 10% of $600,000 is $60,000 plus closing costs. That's why I always remember that number, $87,000. And 18 months later, after we repositioned the asset, took care of it, cleaned it up, we pulled out, we refinanced $164,000. We put that money and we invested it into our next deal. And that asset today is probably worth $2.5 million right now. So we've been able to hold it. We've been able to manage it. And the reason why we've held it for so long, it's in an emerging market. It's an easy asset to continue to, you know, manage. And it's producing a lot of cash flow for us.
And then when you moved on to your next deal, were you still buying them as a three-way with your partner and your brother? I think it was your brother.
Yeah.
Did you do stuff on your own? Did you do stuff with other people?
On our second deal, 3 months later, I found my partner, Mike, who was the balance sheet guy, and it was four of us on the second deal. And going forward after that, third, fourth, fifth, was just me, Jake, and my partner, Mike. What we ended up doing in 2018, we're running out of capital. We've got 800 units. We're refinancing money out. We started syndicating. We started raising capital for our deal. So we've done three syndications as well. And it's just one tool in the tool belt. Syndication has been the rage the last few years. There's been so much capital. And for us, we've gone the other way. We stopped syndicating in 2020 and just started buying deals internally. And what we've done also is we've had our employees invest with us. So it's a typical type of syndication where the last four deals we've done, any employee that was with us for more than 2 years, they're able to invest with us dollar for dollar. So that's really built culture. It's really built. There's nothing like hearing a property manager say, we need to raise rents, because all of a sudden they have ownership. They're like, we need to drive NOI. I'm like, oh, you need to drive NOI because you want the refi check. You want that money out so you can invest in the next deal. So for us, it was buying joint ventures, buying ourselves, then going into the syndication model, and now coming back and buying deals ourselves.
And how do you typically structure a syndication deal? I mean, do they all differ, or is it pound for pound, or you're looking for a silent partner, presumably not someone who's going to, you're bringing some capital and your expertise, and you want someone else to bring their capital and keep the mouth shut to you?
I don't want to sound like a lawyer, but it depends. Every deal is different. The typical structure is you have a general partner who runs the deal, finds the deal. Let's say I'm the general partner. I'm running the deal. I'm finding the deal. I'm signing on the debt. I may typically own, let's say, 30% of that deal. Then I'm finding limited partners who are passive, the mats of the world. They don't want to do anything. They're going to sign on the deal, but their risk is only to that deal itself. They're going to contribute the vast majority of the capital. They may control 70%. So I get 30 as the general partner. The limited partners get 70. It may be 80-20. I mean, and the heyday was really, some people are doing 65-35, 60-40. It really depends upon the IRR, what the IRR is on the exit of the deal.
And I know the answer probably again is it depends. But for that 30% that you're getting, 30-35, whatever you do, are you typically not putting in a pro rate? You're not going to put 30% of the capital in for that.
No.
You're going to be putting nothing or a lot less. You're going to bring the debt and the other.
Yeah, usually you don't. I mean, usually general partners don't put money into it. But what they'll do is they'll put money on the limited partner side. So it's a great way to get into a deal. You're getting acquisition fees on the front end as well. So as a general partner, let's say you're taking a $10 million deal down. You're going to charge what we call an acquisition fee, which may be 1% to 5%. So let's say we charge a 2% acquisition fee on a $10 million deal. The general partners would earn $200,000. Typically, banks like to see general partners have about 10% equity of their own money into a deal. So you typically have to put 10% in, but you typically don't have to have any money for that 30% ownership. You're doing all the work. You're taking all of the risk. You're managing this asset.
Your 10% capital you would put in, that would go in as a general partner effectively. So you almost get 40%.
Yeah, exactly. You would go on the LP side. I mean, people would say, well, that's not really fair. Unless you've gotten into the real estate business and understand the amount of work and the amount of risk and the amount of dedication that goes into it, being a limited partner is a good gig. You know, on these deals, they typically structure a preferred rate of return, which we call a hurdle. The first X percent of cash flow goes to the limited partners. So let's say maybe a 7 or 8% return. The first 8% goes all to the limited partners. Then anything after that, it's split up general partner, limited partner. Then at the end, when you sell the deal or you refinance the deal, proceeds get split certain way, whether it's 70-70-30, however the waterfall goes. And you're just trying to hit an internal rate of return at the end to make sure that the investors get that. And then however well you do, that's how the general partner makes money. So if you're only getting back 12%, general partners, if they're not performing on these deals, they may not get paid at the end. Does that make sense?
So absolutely. So how did you go from buying your deals to educating other people?
I retired from the restaurant and I didn't have a job. So I came down to Florida and I'm like, Jake, let's start buying in Florida. But I had seen in Florida the shift. I had seen the expenses. I had seen the asset prices. Even in 2017 and 18, just exploding. And I'm like, I couldn't make sense of these cap rates. I couldn't make sense of valuations. So I'm like, Jake, let's continue to buy in Knoxville. And at the time we started writing a book, and for us, it was probably one of the best things we did for our investing journey, because we actually learned the framework. We learned the model and we became much better investors. And then all of a sudden we're starting a podcast. We're investing other brokers. We're building our brand. So, you know, brokers would see us online and go, hey, Jake and Gino, I've got this deal for you. So I just started to want to monetize the brand. But after that, I'm like, Jake, this is friggin' awesome. People are sending us deals. People know who we are in the market. We're building credibility. And then from there, we started building a community. And I think I love the business. I love the idea of coaching others. I became a certified life coach. And to me, creating impact for others and creating that community was something that I truly love. I just really enjoy doing that. I enjoy seeing students leave their jobs. I think about 120 of our students so far have left their jobs to pursue real estate full time. That's what gives me, sole purpose. That's what gives me joy in life. It may sound crazy to a lot of the listeners, but once you become financially free and you buy another 100 units, 100, it's a lot of fun. It's enjoyable. But when you can help others do it, and it is, for me, it's I love it. I truly enjoy it.
And what does the educational program look like for your students? It's like a fixed term thing, or it's an ongoing mentorship and community, or you co-fund and find deals together?
For us, we have something a little different than others. A lot of the educators in the space will start a community to be able to raise capital from their students. So it's a sort of like, hey, you know what? I'm going to join this, you know, create this education, teach people how to do it. But then the students will be like, I don't want to do it. Let me give Gino money. We don't raise capital from students, but what we do is we have the community ongoing lifetime. We have about 5 or 6 internal events a year where students come together, they meet each other, they network. And, you know, multifamily, like most other businesses in real estate, it's a team sport. You can't do everything. You can't find investors. You can't run deals. You can't asset manage. You can't property manage. So you're finding team members and other people who can help you either raise the capital or find the deals. And it's open source. I mean, you're going on and you're saying to yourself, I live in New York. This market sucks to invest. But hey, Tony lives in North Carolina. Let me see if I can partner with Tony. I've got some money. Tony's got the boots on the ground. And that's how Jake and I started. Jake was the boots on the ground in Knoxville. I was living in New York. And I love that model. And being able to put people together and being able to have that group is where the networking and the accountability are the two of the hugest pieces you can have in the education space.
So your framework of buy right, manage right, and finance right, that was something you developed for yourselves before the educational program, but now that is part of the framework and the structure that you teach. Can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. So Matt, you're going out, you're going to start buying a multifamily or even a single family home. The first part is the buy right. So when you're doing a buy right, you need to create your criteria. And what does that mean by criteria? The first thing is you need to select the market. Let's select a market or a city or a submarket. For us, it was Knoxville. So from there, we start looking at markets and cities and neighborhoods. I want to look at median incomes of that market because I want to be in certain areas. I've bought in areas that the median income is less desirable. It's a lot harder. I've learned that lesson. So first thing is we try to target median income. Let's say $50,000. That's what our median income is in Knoxville. The second thing is, let's get really crystal clear. I don't want to be in any flood zone. So let's knock out flood zones. If this deal we're looking at is in a flood zone, that's an X against it. The next thing is how many units you can go up to. For us, we're up to 300 units. But be crystal clear on the number of units that you can afford. The next one is, what's the unit mix? Do you like studios? Do you like one bedrooms? You like two bedrooms. We love two bedroom townhomes with garages because they're more of an apartment kind of living. The next thing is, what's the age of the asset? Well, we like newer assets now in this part of the market cycle. So we're looking at 1980s and newer. The next thing is, we like amenities and properties. We like washer, dryer, hookups. And the list goes on and on. So wherever you are, when you're buying a piece of real estate, understand what your buy right criteria is. So for us, real quick, when I'm talking to a broker, 1980s build, 250 units, median income of 50,000 plus. We love two bedroom townhomes. If you got washer and dryers, we love clubhouse, fitnesses. We like brick, you know, pitch roofs. That's how you become really successful in this business, understanding the clarity of what kind of asset you want. Now translate that into any business or any other real estate, create the buy right criteria for what you're trying to buy or what you're trying to invest in. Then the finance right is where people have gone wrong in this part of the market cycle where they're getting the short-term bridge debt. And what happened if you got this short-term debt 2 years ago, it's coming due now. you know, your exit was 4.5, but rates now are 8 and 9 in some markets. So you've just gotten completely crushed. So we like longer term fixed rate financing. We've been saying that forever. And that's why these assets have really exploded in price, because people are getting short term debt. They thought they were going to flip out of it and they weren't able to flip out of it. So understand that longer term fixed rate financing works really well in our space. And then obviously the third component is the manage right. And even with the business, you're buying a business, great. You need to manage that business. You need to manage it for cash flow. You need to manage it for the operations of the business. So when you're putting all three of these together, that's how you're successful in this business. And I think one other thing that we made a mistake on, Matt, when we started out, we never thought of our exit strategy. And I think, you know, private equity, and I really think that people are building businesses to exit in 3 or 5 years, understand they're building something and they have an exit plan. Well, most investors, when they first start out, they say to themselves, I need a deal. I need any kind of deal. They don't know what kind of deal it is, but they think they need a deal. But the second part is, well, what is your exit with this deal? Are you going to hold this deal for long term, like Jake and I like to do? Or are you going to hold this deal for 2 or 3 years, flip out, and then get into a bigger deal or a better deal or trade up, as we say in real estate? So understanding that three-step framework and then understanding what your exit strategy is will make you so much more successful than just somebody going out there saying, I want to get into real estate and find a deal.
You mentioned a couple of times two-bedroomed townhouses.
Yes.
But you mean on a complex, so lots of two-bedroom yes. townhouses together.
Yes. Not, yes. Yeah, excuse me. Yeah. And the problem is, you know, a lot of assets have studios or efficiencies. In some markets, those work really well. But in Knoxville, they're really difficult not only to rent, but just to keep them rented. They're transient. They tend to turn over a lot, and turnover costs tend to be expensive. So we'd like to have larger assets, two-bedroom townhomes. It's because when a person rents a two-bedroom townhome, it feels more like a house. They tend to stay longer. They're a better quality resident. Now, that first deal we bought had a 6-studio efficiency on it. So you can see how we've learned over the years to really change our criteria. And that asset works really well because we bought it for the right price point, but there's a lot of 1 bedrooms on there. There's a little bit more turnover, but we can deal with it because the price point that we're in just makes it work.
And what is the whole concept for you guys of multifamilies, and why multifamily? Why not for individual units?
So multifamily is just, it lends itself to scalability. I mean, when we first started, Jake was working as a pharmaceutical rep full time, and I was a pizza guy. Can you imagine buying 25 single family homes scattered all throughout the city? I mean, I couldn't imagine buying 3 or 4. That means you'd have to have 25 titles, 25 insurances, 25 tax bills. Our first deal, we'd have 25 unit complex. It was contiguous, all in one location. It was so much easier to manage. You're basically buying 25 boxes. They're all very similar, a lot easier to manage. 3 months later, we bought a 36 unit. So within 3 months, we've got 60 units. Could you imagine 60 single family homes all over the place? It'd be a freaking nightmare. I don't want to say impossible to manage, but it'd be very difficult to manage. Instead, having these assets in contiguous locations close to each other and all in the same parcel of land, it's easier to manage. And what I love about it is multifamily lends itself to scalability. You can start hiring. We hired after that second deal, we had resident managers, but on our third deal, we were able to hire full-time property managers. We were able to hire full-time maintenance techs. It's just much easier to scale the business plan with multifamily as opposed to doing single family.
And how many different states are you in?
We are actually just in 2 states. We had properties in Kentucky and in East Tennessee and Knoxville. And we're what we call vertically integrated. We manage our own assets. So you can do it either way in real estate. You can hire a third-party property management company, or you can, you know, manage the assets yourselves. We didn't know any better when we started. We're like, hey, we're going to manage our own assets. We're going to learn, right? And then just all of a sudden, Jake loved doing it. He was getting paid pretty good money to do it. And he decided, let's continue along. You know, there's pros and cons. If you're managing your own stuff, you won't be able to scale as quick because you have to have payroll. You have to have infrastructure. If you're doing third party and raising money, you can scale a lot quicker, but you won't have the control. So it's either having more control or being able to scale quicker, a lot quicker. So we just decided, hey, let's focus on the profit of each complex as opposed to just scaling up and just getting a lot larger.
And how are you seeing the market change? How are you seeing the economy change? You know, are you getting tail off in buy prices now? Are you finding units harder to rent?
We have been able to close on 300 units in the last year, and for us, it's been an excellent market for us to buy, because you have these mom and pop sellers. They weren't selling a year or two ago. They weren't afraid of the market. They weren't afraid of the economy. They weren't afraid of all these wars going on. And now if you have this motivated seller in real estate, which is what you need, if the seller's not motivated, you're not going to make a deal. And for us, we're seeing the motivation come back to these sellers. If they have to sell, great. And the other thing that I've seen is brokers are calling us back. We're actually having real estate brokers call back. They're actually asking us to put in offers. Whereas a year ago or 2 years ago, there was no motivation. There was so much money out there, and there's still euphoria in the market. Rates were still low. There was still a lot of people getting into these deals. And one reason why there's less people getting into deals today is if I'm running a property right now and I'm in distress and I have investors and there's a deal that comes out, I can't go and raise capital for that deal because my deals that I have right now are not performing. And we're seeing a lot of that in the market right now. So a lot of these deals that are hitting the market, there's less buyers. And when there's less buyers, it's supply and demand. There's less demand for the asset and prices are dropping.
But you're not scared about the future. You're buying for the long term. You're locking in long-term finance, and you're happy to ride out any storm.
You know, I made those mistakes in 08. Remember, we discussed it. The mistakes that we're making now, for anybody on this call, the market is a cycle. There's four cycles in a real estate market. There's, you know, recovery, expansion, hypersupply, and recession. It's a buyer's market and then a seller's market. When I got into it back in 2011, I realized it was a buyer's market. And then the seller's market started expanding in 2017, 18, 19, 20. And now we're entering a buyer's market again. It's just driven by interest rates as well, driven by the economy. So I don't want to say I'm scared or not. There's always the fear that, you know, your portfolio may take a hit. There's always a fear that, you know, the economy loses jobs, because our multifamily is based on jobs and based on the economy. Fortunately for us in Tennessee, we've got people moving to that market. So, you know, if you're going to get into real estate and multifamily, it is market specific. It is market dependent. If you're in a great location where jobs are coming, where people have, you know, where people are moving to, I mean, that's what's really helped us in our market. We've got people moving from California to Tennessee. That's never happened in the history of the United States. No one's left California to come to Tennessee. But over the last 3 or 4 years, it's happened a lot, because California's becoming untenable, whether it's the political environment, whether it's the economic environment. They can come to Tennessee and cut their bills in half. Why wouldn't you do that? I mean, you know, I mean, other than California is an amazing place to live, it's beautiful, but it's becoming untenable for a lot of people. And I think the market has really helped us. And for us, just executing the business plan and looking at it from that perspective and not outgrowing our infrastructure, not going and buying deals just to buy deals, but really focusing on the operations is what I think is going to pull us through any down cycle.
Has your buy criteria changed much over the years? Or
great, or the same question. Kind of stuff? I love that question, because you're thinking like a business guy. It absolutely changes. When we started, prices were lower, assets were cheaper, especially these older properties. But as the market cycle has shifted, the prices for these older properties all of a sudden went up because people were bidding for them. So right now, the older properties and the newer properties are sort of the same price point. The only problem with these older properties are there's a lot more work, what we call deferred maintenance. So that's why we've shifted now to buying newer assets, because newer assets have less work on them. Those older assets you're talking about, some of them have aluminum wiring. Some of them have knob and tube for electric breakers. Some of them have cast iron plumbing. And there's nothing wrong with that stuff if you can budget for it and pay for it. But the pricing over the last couple of years just shot up so much that it made it, once again, untenable to buy it at that price point. So that's why your market cycle is constantly evolving through the market cycles. And I think right now, as these prices tend to adjust and go down, we're going to look at the older assets. It's not saying that we're not looking at the older assets. We just don't want to pay the price points that they're at right now. I'd rather buy something newer with a little bit less work, especially considering, since I want to hold this deal for the next 10 or 15 years. If it's newer, it's got a much longer, you know, life cycle, as opposed to the older ones that, hey, you got to put a ton of work into them. And at the end of the day, they're still old.
When does something come onto your sell radar? You know, what is making that? I mean, you're going into it with a long-term approach anyway, but what happens for you to decide it's time to cash out on this one?
It's another great question. For us, it's one, functional obsolescence. We bought an asset that is just older, that has smaller units, that has, we love central air conditioning in our units. It just attracts better residents. We've had, you know, units that have in the air, in the window, we've sold those assets. An asset that has a, had a good run up, but there's foundation issues. An asset that's in a location that's marginal. Like I said, we bought an asset that had pretty bad median income. I mean, there was crime going on throughout the day. We didn't even know that. We would go on the property at night to see how it was. It was fine. During the day, you have people running around and doing crazy stuff. So I think when the market or the city starts shifting, we tend to sell. And also our syndications, when we have syndications, we have investors. We have a fiduciary responsibility to our investors to return their capital. So our syndications, we've gone full cycle on them and we've returned the capital to them. There's always a time to sell an asset. If you've got an asset and you've got a ton of equity in there, what's your return on equity? It may be smaller. If you have another opportunity, well, maybe you sell this asset here and repurpose that capital into a bigger asset or into a better asset.
So tell me about your podcast. You mentioned earlier that you got one. Obviously, I can see in the background, there seems to be two there. You've got Jake and Gino and Julie and Gino as well. So where did that come from and what happens on the show?
Well, with Julie and Gino, I started the podcast with the wife around 4 years ago. And I have to say it's one of the best therapy sessions I have throughout the week because it's a lot of fun. I mean, we just interviewed Michael Franzese, you know, the mob guy. We just interviewed J.P. Sears. I mean, we interviewed Dr. Gary Chapman of the Five Love Languages. All of these people that are amazing, and me and my wife are interviewing them. And for what I love about it, it's all about family. It's about communication. It's about relationships. I think people ultimately want multifamily, but there's such a desire to learn how to have that communication with your wife, to learn how to connect with your kids, because entrepreneurship is lonely. It's really hard work. And for me, I love working with my spouse, and I just want to be a role model to those out there saying to themselves, hey, I can't work with my wife. And I thought that was the case as well. But for me, I just love working with her. I love showing people that family is so important. It's such an important component to this world that people are lacking. And I want to be a role model for anyone out there who wants to be a stronger dad, who wants to be a better dad. That's what that show is focused on. And the Jake and Gino show, we interview entrepreneurs. We interview anyone in the multifamily space, thought leaders. I love that show because it gives me an hour a week to be able to sit down with guys like you who are working at a high level, learning what they're doing. And one thing I've learned, Matt, through that show is business is business. Whether you're in the multifamily business, you're in the restaurant business, you're in the car business, it all comes down to some core fundamental, you know, truths and beliefs in business. And you can steal something from what somebody's doing in their business and implement it into your business. That's why I love that show. It's like a weekly mastermind with me, Jake, and a guest every week.
I always say the same thing about my podcast. So, you know, if nobody were to ever to listen to a single episode, then I've still won because I've got yep. to sit down and have great conversations with great people. You know, almost, like you say, private masterminds. You know, the amount of times I've had a problem or had something I want to learn, I thought, you know, who's an expert in that? Who owns that business? Or I'll reach out to them and get them on the podcast. You know, I guess not under the guise, but you know, for them to come on and tell their story. But I can then use it as a chance to say, by the way, I've got these 10 questions I need to pick your brains on.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because even meeting you today, I've never met anyone from Dubai. I've never spoken to anyone who lived in Dubai. I've never spoken to someone with your background. So it's really cool that now my paradigm has changed. I didn't know that Dubai was, I knew it was wealthy, but I didn't think there was that much wealth and that much opportunity out there. So just having the conversation with you this morning changed my paradigm on something. And you're just trying to expand your knowledge and you're trying to become, I don't want to say more worldly, but have that experience from others when you don't have it. And if you're sitting at home by yourself all the time and not having these conversations, well, you're not growing. You're regressing.
And does Jake do podcasts too? Or are you the more kind of public face or do you do stuff together?
Yeah, more of the public face, but we do the show together. So I tend to go on other people's shows myself and I'm part of the educational company. So I run the Jake and Gino Education and Jake runs the property management day to day. And what's great about it, it just there's such a symbiotic relationship because we find vendors through the education. We learn so much stuff through our education, whether it's non-refundable moving deposits, whether it's asset protection, whether it's a syndication attorney, tax strategies, all these things we're learning through the education. We're just implementing in our business as well, which is pretty cool.
So what does the future hold? What's the next 5 or 10 years of Jake and Gino?
Great question. I have no idea. That's not the question. That's not the answer you probably want to hear, but it's education.
It's an honest answer. I like
yes.
it.
You know, I want to be honest. Because when you think about education, it's one of those things where you want to monetize. I'd rather be more concerned with the brand and have brand awareness and utilize the brand to be able to become a thought leader in multifamily, where we can create more deal flow for ourselves and then obviously help students along the process. There's a significant investment to make when you work with Jake and Gino. And right now it's more challenging. I mean, there are people that are afraid right now. And it's same thing as 08 and 09, when you're out there hearing all these news outlets saying that the economy is falling and crashing and real estate's really risky right now. Well, that's where we are right now with the educational. But I'm just here to tell everybody, shut that off. Don't listen to that news, because they told us there was no inflation. They told us that, you know, COVID was going to destroy the economy. They told us a lot of things that they didn't know. And now they're telling us that rates aren't going to drop. They don't know. They're just as clueless as anybody else. So work on your business, work on yourself. And for me, just continuing to create value for the community and for the students. It's ironic, but it ultimately creates more value for my life and for my team as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, listen, Gino, it's been an absolute pleasure listening to you, buddy. Love the conversation. Plenty for me to learn, and I'm sure plenty for the guys listening at home. How do we find you? Give yourself a little shout out. You know, you're on social. You've got a website. Where do we come and find you?
Just go to jakeandgino.com. I mean, if anybody wants a copy of our book, Wheel of Our Profits, email me, gino@jakeandgino.com, and I'll shoot you over a PDF copy. And like I said, if you're in any business, in any real estate venture, buy right, manage right, and finance right will help you close that next deal.
Perfect. Well, listen, thanks again, Gino. I look forward to doing a round two with you at some point in the future, and love to hear some more stories in how you've succeeded in the challenging market ahead.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate it, brother.